This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in.
American journalist and diplomat John Lewis O'Sullivan, in an editorial supporting the annexation of what is now the state of Texas, was the first to put in print the jingoistic term manifest destiny. The tenet expresses the belief that territorial expansion for the United States was not only inevitable, but divinely ordained. I guess not much has changed. Similar thinking may have been involved when Christian right evangelist Pat Robertson benignly mentioned that the assassination of Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez might be appropriate. As has been pointed out before, it appears what should rightfully be our oil seems to be trapped under his third-rate country and that giant sandbox known as the Middle East. But prior practitioners of imperialism may be predictably more apt at reflecting on the failures of political arrogance. The BBC recently reported that UK Foreign Secretary Jack Straw has opined that Britain's imperial past may be responsible for many modern political dilemmas, the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Kashmiri dispute, among others. After World War II, it was the Brits who pasted together the country we now know as Iraq, from what was originally three Ottoman provinces. And if misery does love company, it may be reassuring to members of our Congress today that Winston Churchill once wrote to Prime Minister David Lloyd George, "Why are we compelled to go on pouring armies and treasures into these thankless deserts?" Why indeed? Well, there is the oil. And then there's the spoils of privatization, contractor heaven, and just plain war profiteering. Kathy talks with author, war correspondent, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Peter Arnett.
13 years in Vietnam, both Gulf Wars. What drives war after war in the first place? Is it the defense industry and people's interest in those industries?
That is all part of it, of course, Kathy. The U.S. has a very large standing army. It has a professional officer corps. You know, certainly since World War II, you know, it has aspired to be the most important power in the world. The defense industry has provided the weaponry and the technology to allow the U.S. to be the greatest power in the world. So certainly those who are within that structure, within the Defense Department, and those who are elected to office, and those who are, you know, the governments that come to the people who go to office are ambitious, and they have around them people with agendas. You know, if you elect, you know, a president with those around him who really believe that U.S. power can change the world, then you have, say, a Vietnam in which those around President Kennedy and Johnson, like Robert McNamara, thought it would be relatively simple to democratize, you know, distant parts of the world. Or as you have around President Bush, those like Vice President Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and former Assistant Defense Secretary Wolfowitz, who believed it would aid America's, you know, your power ambitions to move to, say, the Middle East aggressively. And it's all part of the whole equation, right? Strong army, strong Defense Department, strongly, you know, ideological people in the White House and the Defense Department. It all comes together in war. And if you know, the media would be a balance and a controlling factor. And I think during the Vietnam War and the years afterwards, the media was, you know, a significant factor in American policy, foreign policy. It did challenge, you know, the government fairly successfully, even though Reagan got away with the Central American policy, because even so, people were aware of it. Almost led to his impeachment, the Iran-Contra affair. But 9/11 came, and the U.S. Government and people quickly got back to sort of a World War II mode, believing at the time that the country was imperiled, and sort of responding to the clarion call of those who believe that the U.S. should strike out, when indeed those within the administration figured that, well, we're this far, why not move on and achieve some other goals, such as greater control over the oil region, you know, getting rid of people we personally don't like Saddam Hussein. I mean, President Bush said that this is the guy that tried to kill my dad, you know, before the war. So sort of was a personal vendetta. Why not go and do it? We have the weaponry, we have the people, we have the, we have the power. And they just walked into Iraq, not even heeding the suggestion that, wait a minute, this is a warrior country, and they may not like it.
Yeah. You kept in touch, I know, with General Westmoreland for some time after Vietnam. Did he ever let down his guard and have any hindsight thoughts?
You know, that is a very good question. And in fact, I did occasionally see him. He died last year. But I did occasionally bump into him. Well, the fact that he was quite personable to me and friendly indicated that, you know, whatever doubts or suspicions he had about the media, which he seemed to suggest in Vietnam, he had come to terms with that. In fact, he did tell me a few times that, you know, I did a lot of stories out of Vietnam for the Associated Press, maybe 3,000 or 4,000, that he basically didn't quarrel with what I said. He was very angry with one story in which I wrote that each morning he had a tennis lesson or played tennis with a tennis pro at the sports club in Saigon for relaxation and for exercise. And on the basis of that story, he stopped playing. And he said that was the one that hurt him the most. So now what does that say about the general? But he seemed to, I think, in the end, believe that the media was justified in challenging the war, even though he said specifically in terms of battle to battle, he felt that the U.S. had achieved its goal there. But, you know, Westmoreland was not an ideologue. I mean, he was a professional soldier who was given a very tough job in Vietnam and failed at that job and paid for the rest of his life. He paid for it. He was looked at as being, you know, incompetent, stupid. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, he had some aspects of his personality and character which we sort of need in our military man today.
Yeah. Well, just telling that story, Peter, it just occurred to me that those of us who remain huge fans of yours, it has a lot to do with being able to say that the emperor has no clothes. You've been excellent at ticking off a lot of people, all the right people.
Well, that comes with the territory. You don't forget, you know, I was very high-profile organizations I worked for, the Associated Press, then CNN, and the higher you get up, the higher you get up in shall we say, prominence of the organization, the greater effectiveness you were. And I thought I was the proudest part of my career was that I was able to challenge authority for, you know, 40 years from the highest pinnacles of the news organizations, the mainstream news organizations, and basically resist attempts to sort of, as you say, dethrone me or to destroy my career.
If you're just joining us, this is Voices of Our World, and we're talking with journalist and author Peter Arnett.
It was only at the end of my career, you know, when I was 69 years of age and covering Iraq for NBC, that they basically were able to say, put me off the air. I think that's not a bad record, Kathy.
It's a great record, Peter. Lastly, at this point in your career, which is far from over, and with an eye to the title of the book that you've just accomplished, Feet to the Fire, I'm wondering what, when all is said and done, are your satisfactions and or your dissatisfactions?
With the media?
Yeah.
I had hoped for a long time that advances in technology and the advances of information gathering and dispensing that information, you know, to people in the U.S. and around the world would be a tremendous advantage for the public and understanding what was happening in the world. And as more news organizations grew with the arrival of, say, CNN 24-hour news, that when it was started by Ted Turner, that was ridiculed, the idea that people wouldn't want 24-hour news. And then you get onto talk radio, and then you have, you know, the Internet and so many other, and satellite television, satellite radio. But looking at it all now, I think it adds up to a lot of sort of confusion in the public mind. I think in one sense you have See, this phenomenon of blogging, we're on the internet, anyone can sort of have their own, you know, their own pulpit to present their views. But I read recently there were 27 million bloggers. So just imagine trying to wade through all that material. You can't wade through all that material. And it's, and I think the public sort of has to lean just as heavily on its elected officials for information, and sort of the few remaining mainstream media that are clearly apparent for information, as it always has done in the past. What is interesting to me is that within this massive information and communications development, there has risen a very clear-cut, you know, media or clear-cut commentators and those with a political agenda. I'm talking about the right-wing agenda here. It's just it's Rush Limbaugh and the conservative radio, which has so long dominated radio. And it's the effectiveness of Fox News, it's the Wall Street Journal. They basically speak in one voice, and certainly in the case of the Bush administration, protective of the Bush administration, slashing out at enemies, whether it's Peter Arnett or it's a Democratic politician or it's an individual that displeases the administration. You have this, it's added to the government firewall, all this cacophony of supported voices, which, you know, you don't have on the other side, the liberal side of the country. Mm. And I think this has been dismaying. It's taken, you know, 3 years now before the reality has got through to the American public that Iraq was a bad move to make, and it's not successful. What is the future of the media? I think it's muddled. I just see the New York Times being degraded to some degree by this massive media, and some part of it its own fault. But it's a sort of a confusion in the public mind. My concern is that the public will sort of continue retreating towards soft news, DVDs, you know, entertainment, and be less concerned about these important issues, which would be really unfortunate.
If the United States government is considering pursuing an expanded war in the Middle East in the name of the war on terror, are you with them or against them? Email us at radio@maryknoll.org or go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us or call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Robert Dreyfus and Peter Arnett are just two of the voices of our world. And I'm your host, Eileen Bott. This week's show was produced by Kathy Golden. And you heard music today by Smodge, Cole Porter and Bing Crosby, Richard Stone, and Tom Ruger. Our website is www.voicesofourworld.org, where you can listen, learn more about today's guests and topics, answer our weekly question, or subscribe to our podcast. Please go to www.voicesofourworld.org. To learn more about Mary Knoll, or try Mary Knoll Magazine in English or Spanish, call 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.